You're about to have a new audio experience. Same podcast you love, with a few new audio tweaks. When William Foster and his younger brother were sent to prison for a daring robbery, the conviction sparked an insane sequence of events. By the time the Foster gang was finished with South Africa, 12 people would be dead, many more forever changed by their actions, and in some incredibly bizarre ways, the history of our country would be altered. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 202. The Foster Gang. This episode is sponsored by IntegriSure. I talk about some of the most serious crimes on this podcast, but crimes like smash and grabs and house break-ins happen much more frequently, and accidents happen too. As a podcaster and freelancer, I rely heavily on my laptop and phone. If something happened to them and I wasn't insured, it would be a huge problem. Plus, you'd all definitely be asking where the next episode is. IntegriSure has been operating as one of South Africa's top short-term insurance brokers for almost 30 years. And I know that as I've gotten older, I've definitely felt more of a need to protect what I've built through hard work with a broker that understands me. IntegriSure doesn't just do car and home insurance, though. They also think about the stuff you probably wouldn't even consider until you need it. Road and home assist, advice from experienced brokers, and a range of value-add products like pet insurance. Because somehow, Fluffy always seems to get into it with the neighbor's cat when the budget is already tight. We all try to be intentional about protecting ourselves, and that should definitely apply to your choice in insurance brokers too. Visit www.integrisure.co.za to connect. IntegriSure, car, home, and business insurance for the generation that does not take chances. IntegriSure is an authorized financial services provider. True Crime South Africa is an independent podcast and relies on listener support to keep going. There are many ways you can support the podcast. You can check out all of them at truecrimesouthafrica.com. The most impactful way is by joining the Patreon community. Patreon members get free access to TCSA events, exclusive episodes, discounts on my audiobooks, and ad-free episodes. So you don't have to listen to me say this every week. You can join the Patreon community from just $2, around 32 Rand a month. And if you aren't big on commitment, not only is there a free 7-day trial, but you can also cancel at any time. New Patreon supporters get a shout-out when they join. Listen through to the end for that. Patreon/True Crime South Africa. Please. And thank you. I've been asked to cover this case a lot. And while I do occasionally get requests for what I call vintage true crime cases, it's usually the more common ones, Daisy DeMalka and the like. And to be honest, I didn't really understand what the fuss was about. A bunch of guys who committed some robberies. Well, I was wrong. And once I started really getting into the minutiae of this case, I understood what the interest was about. Very much like the Stunder Gang, which I covered in episode 49, I was concerned that this gang had become part of folklore and that its members had almost been made into these Robin Hood-like entities. Just like with Stunder, who did some pretty terrible things besides his bank robberies, William Foster and his crew were not upstanding citizens, out to settle a score with the system. In researching this case, I used Ted Boerter's book, Daisy DeMalca, in which he very cleverly weaves all of the country's most notorious criminals on that timeline into one tale. I also used a chapter from the book Famous South African Crimes by Rob Marsh, several historical documents I found online, information from genealogy websites, and, completely unsurprisingly, this time absolutely no social media information. So let's get into episode 202, The Foster Gang.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information in our show notes.
To truly understand why any of this ever happened, we have to focus pretty deeply on the origin story of the man whose name the gang would bear. William Henry Foster. Now, you might, like I did, find William referred to by other first names in other resources. The first name Robert is used quite a lot. As you'll discover, William Foster started using aliases very early on in his life, and it seems that some of those stuck. He was also born in a time when lots of additional names were given to children, so it's entirely possible, although he was listed as only having the middle name Henry in most reputable sources, he could have had an additional name, which was Robert, and sometimes went by that. In all actual official sources, though, his name is William, so that's what I'm going to go with. William was born in 1886 in Griqualand East, an area which now primarily forms part of the KwaZulu-Natal province, with parts also in the Eastern Cape. The closest modern touchpoint for positioning would be Kokstad. He was born to his parents, an Irishman, John Foster, and his mother, South African-born Elizabeth. The family would eventually have six children in total, three boys and three girls. When the Second Boer War ended in 1902, the Foster family moved to Johannesburg, and the three Foster boys, including William, were sent to school at Marist Brothers College. The Foster family was later described as, quote, perfectly normal and responsible. Of course, that would only need to be clarified once two of their sons had attached their family name to a string of pretty atrocious crimes. But in 1902, the Foster family was quite happily making a life for themselves in the City of Gold. William Foster was a star pupil academically, and he was also a gifted sportsman. But he did struggle with authority. He was described from a collection of remarks by those who knew him as follows. Quote, William as a boy was lively and attractive, with strong features, bright grey eyes, and a ready smile. He held his head high and his shoulders straight. And when he walked, he gave an extraordinary impression of electric energy, as if his body and limbs were tautened by some strange inner force. End quote. William's father was a builder and worked away from home a lot, so he didn't really have much to do with raising the children on a day-to-day basis. His mother was left with most decisions about discipline, and most said that Elizabeth Foster had a soft spot for her son, more so than may have been to his benefit in the long run. William got into what seemed like some normal teenage boy's stuff during his school years, but his shining academic and sporting record always seemed to get him off pretty lightly. When he matriculated, he was accepted by one of the gold mines to work as an apprentice surveyor to do a four-year course. His father purchased a motorcycle for him to get to and from work, and that would become something that William would carry with him and eventually also become part of the Foster Gang legend. During his first year of apprenticeship, William started dabbling in photography, and he loved it so much that he told his father he wanted to quit his apprenticeship and study photography full-time. His father forbade it, and although William sort of acquiesced, he also decided to combine the two and started taking photographs underground for mining magazines. He converted the shed in his parents' yard into a darkroom and also started learning how to cut keys. In among all of this learning and enjoying newfound talents, though, William is also headed down a dangerous road. On several occasions, he clashed with the law. Once, he was involved in a violent, drunken brawl outside a pub and refused to listen to police officers. He was given a fine. Then, on several occasions, he was found riding the train without a ticket, even though he had more than enough money in his pocket to buy one. On each occasion, as soon as he was caught, he would run. Sometimes, he got away, but he was often caught, and he was eventually convicted, fined, and sent to prison for a month. When he got out, he announced that he was setting off to travel and take photographs. His first destination was Namibia, which was then German Southwest Africa. And it was on that trip that things really started to go sideways for William Foster. No one actually knows what he got up to on that trip, but after disappearing for several months, Foster was found by police in Namibia with torn clothes, unshaven, and dishevelled, driving a pack of donkeys, which he seemed intent on getting over the border into South Africa. The donkeys did not belong to him and had been reported stolen by a farmer weeks earlier. While William hadn't really seemed to see the harm in what he was doing, claiming that he'd always intended to pay the farmer back, he just needed the donkeys so he could afford to get back to South Africa, he didn't seem to realise just how serious a crime stock theft was in the country he was visiting. Already at this point, William was providing aliases when he was arrested, but that didn't prevent him from getting a pretty heavy penalty for his crime. He was outraged, and although he served less than 6 months, the authors of a book later written about this case say that this jail term had seemed to change William as a person. And from that point, he was, quote, driven by some deeper force into an attitude of rebellion. Although up to this point, William had only been convicted of non-violent crimes, it would later emerge that police officers in Marshall Square in Johannesburg were keeping an eye on the young man for something quite different. One of William's sisters had died. There's very little information available about her death, and in fact, she isn't listed in any of the records I could find of the family. Her manner of death was eventually ruled as suicide, but detectives at Marshall Square had serious suspicions that it was actually murder, and William had allegedly been a strong suspect. When William was released from his sentence for stock theft in 1912, he was intent on continuing his travels, and he headed to England for a while. By 1913, he was back in South Africa and headed for Cape Town on the Union Limited steam train from Johannesburg. And it would be on this train that he would meet one of the men who would help to start the series of events that were about to unfold. John Maxim was in his late 30s, a good 10 years older than William. But when fates put them in adjoining seats on the Union Limited, the two men soon realized, as much as their backgrounds were different, they had lots of all the wrong, or right for their purposes, things in common. It was Maxim's strong accent which at first intrigued William. Although John had arrived in South Africa from America at the turn of the century, his accent was still deeply pronounced, and he regaled anyone who would listen with tales of his performances at the Wild West Show and Circus, where he'd worked as a trick horse rider and shooter. Part of the fascination of the story was an accident Maxim had had while performing, during which his arm had been crushed, and two of his fingers were deformed after being broken and not setting properly. Most of the young men who joined the travelling show were drifters who hadn't stayed for very long. But John Maxim didn't have any other skills, and he'd hoped the show would be a long-term gig for him. Unfortunately, the show's curator had died, and with him so had the show. And now Maxim was without work and headed to Cape Town, hoping for new horizons. Maxim had dabbled in a few things before leaving Johannesburg, but none of them had been legal, and he was headed to Cape Town as much as he was running away from the reputation and remaining jail time he'd left behind in the City of Gold. Maxim, like William, was a fan of aliases, and he'd used several in Johannesburg. But when his luck had started to run out, he figured a swift exit was best. Of course, we have no idea what the conversation on the train was that day, but we do know that John Maxim and William Foster became fast friends from that moment. And by the time they stepped off the platform in the Mother City, a plan was already forming. The two men moved in together to a lodge called Ebenezer House on Hope Street in Cape Town. And by March 1913, they had a plan in place that they both hoped would net them a good-sized fortune. Despite the difference in age, it's very clear that William Foster was always the leader of what eventually would become the Foster Gang. At some point after arriving in Cape Town, William contacted his younger brother, Jimmy, who was still in Johannesburg, and told him to bring a friend of his and get on the train to Cape Town. Like so many people in the story, the friend has been referred to by different names in different sources. The most reliable of those sources puts his name as Fred Adamson, a young man in his early 20s who'd been a family friend of the Fosters since they'd arrived in Johannesburg. By the time Jimmy Foster and Fred Adamson disembarked, William was already deep in the planning for a crime he wanted them to commit. He and Maxim had stolen a car which they'd use as a getaway vehicle, and they'd identified a truly ambitious target, the American-Swiss Watch Company. On the 19th of March 1913, the four men dressed in some rather poor disguises, just fake beards and moustaches, and waited near the store until they saw the managers starting the process of closing up for the night. The two shopkeepers had started to remove the items in the windows and lock them away, and they pulled the door shut but hadn't locked it when three men entered, brandishing guns. John Maxim had stayed in the car to watch his lookout. In the minutes that followed, the two shopkeepers were bound, gagged, and had hoods pulled over their heads. The gang bagged watches, jewelry, cigarette cases, and more. Most sources put the value of the haul at £5,000, the currency still used in South Africa at that time. As Ted Buerter notes in his book, Daisy DeMelka, if that amount is correct, that means that with a translation over time in buying power, we're talking about an estimated £650,000 today. For a gang of what were essentially petty criminals before that, it was an incredible feat. Before leaving, the men instructed the shopkeepers to wait at least 30 minutes before moving or trying to call for help. They would have someone watching the store, they said, and if either of them attempted to raise the alarm before 30 minutes was up, they would be shot. Of course, the gang did not have anyone watching the store. Instead, they all piled into the car with their loot, and John Maxim tore away from the scene. The deal was that William and Maxim would keep hold of the loot and ensure it was in a safe place. Then, When the heat died down, they would sell it off and split the proceeds. Police arrived at the American-Swiss watch company within minutes of being called. The robbery was significant, and the company would announce a few days later that they were offering a £500 reward to anyone who provided information that led to the successful conviction of the robbers. The day after the robbery, William Foster called a taxi. When it arrived, he loaded a large trunk into the boot and asked to be taken to the railway station. There, he headed to the left luggage section, designed for travellers to securely store bags, suitcases or personal items for a few hours, days or weeks. They provided convenience, allowing passengers to explore without hauling luggage around. William planned to use the lockers to hide the loot on the off chance he and Maxim were identified and police arrived at their lodgings. The key to being a successful criminal is often not drawing attention to yourself. And unfortunately for William Foster, he didn't quite get that part right that day. Foster discovered to his dismay that he didn't have the right amount of money required to pay for the left luggage service. He had a gold sovereign on him, but the luggage clerk, Ernest Sefton, told him that he didn't have change. Instead of just going to break the sovereign into smaller change, Foster threw a tantrum, saying he wasn't going to drag the trunk all around the station to find change, and Sefton could do it. Sefton explained that he could not leave his post, but suggested that he could just leave the trunk there with him, he'd keep an eye on it, and Foster could come back with the change. Still, Foster was unhappy, and insisted that he needed some sort of receipt to prove he'd given him the trunk. Sefton initially explained that he couldn't provide a receipt without receiving money, but Foster became so irate and caused such a scene that the harried luggage clerk eventually just wrote out the ticket and shoved it into the man's hand. Having gotten his way, Foster slinked off and got the change he needed. When he placed the coins in Sefton's hand, he complimented him on showing such trust, as though the poor man had had any choice. When the gang had moved into their lodgings at Ebenezer House, they'd used a bit of an over-the-top cover story. Instead of just saying that they were travelling friends looking for employment in Cape Town, William Foster told people that they were a group of musicians who were in Cape Town to make an appearance at the Opera House. Unfortunately for them, one of the men they told the story to was actually a veteran of the arts and music scene, and he immediately knew that they were lying. The man, Harry Bloom, hadn't known at the time why the four men were lying about their reason for being in the city. But after the big American-Swiss robbery hit the headlines, and then the four men left their lodgings at Ebenezer House shortly afterward, he started to wonder, and soon he was on the phone with police. There are two stories out there about how William Foster and his initial gang came to be arrested for this crime. The first is that as a result of Harry Bloom's call, the rooms at Ebenezer House, which the men had occupied, had been searched, and the police had found clues that had led them to believe the men were the robbers. Then someone at the lodge had told them that William had left in a taxi, and that taxi driver had told them he'd taken William to the train station. The other story was that the search of the train station had been a routine part of the investigation, and they'd been showing around the sketches that had been made of the three gang members who'd been in the shop, created from the shopkeeper's descriptions. The men's disguises, after all, hadn't really been very good. And the story went that when they showed the sketches to the left luggage attendant, Ernest Sefton, he'd identified one of the men as the man who'd made such a big scene about his very heavy trunk. Whichever story is the most accurate, police did find their way to the left luggage section of the train station, and they found the trunk, containing all the valuables William Foster had left behind. He hadn't called himself William Foster on the receipt, though. He'd used an alias. But he'd done that everywhere he went in Cape Town. Police discreetly removed the trunk and then planted several surveillance officers at the train station, certain that the man who had left the hall would be back for it before long. And they weren't wrong. 3 days later, William Foster had decided that the heat had sufficiently died down for him to retrieve some of the valuables and start selling them off. The minute he handed his ticket to Sefton, police descended and arrested him. A few days later, police in Johannesburg arrested Jimmy Foster and Fred Adamson, who'd gone back home on the train. John Maxim, though, was not arrested, and he escaped culpability for this crime entirely. When William Foster was arrested, he was also in possession of a set of keys that belonged to the American Swiss Watch Company and a loaded pistol. He also had two firearm licenses in his possession, one in the name of Robert Ward Jackson, which was one of his aliases, and the other in his own name. William was to be transported back to Johannesburg for his trial, but he would be kept in custody in Cape Town for 2 months before the trial. And before that happened, William pulled off another interesting first. In among all of his wheeling and dealing and travelling and jail stints, William had been dating a woman called Peggy Lyons. The young woman was clearly very committed to William, and when she attended some of his court appearances, it soon became obvious that she was also pregnant. William expressed to those in charge of the jail that he was being kept in that he wished to marry Peggy before he went to trial, as she was with child, and he didn't want to go to prison having not married her. At this point in history, of course, it was still rather scandalous for a child to be conceived, never mind born, out of wedlock, and prison authorities decided it would be best to allow the marriage to go ahead. And so it was that William Foster became the first prisoner in the history of what is now the Western Cape to be given special dispensation to marry while incarcerated, and Peggy Lyons became Peggy Foster. When the trial of the three started in Pretoria in May that year, William Foster seemed relatively confident. He would later say that he knew he would probably get a good few years' sentence because he had prior convictions. But he was certain that his younger brother Jimmy and Fred Adamson would get off relatively lightly, as this was their first conviction. We still had a jury system at that time, and after a jury found all three guilty, after just 25 minutes of deliberation, the judge handed down a sentence that left the usually silver-tongued William Foster gaping and speechless. Judge Kotze gave all three the same sentence, 12 years of hard labour in Pretoria Central. Now, to put this in context, at the time we still had the death sentence available, but there was this weird giant gap between the death sentence and everything else. If murders, for instance, were not seen as premeditated, or the individual seemed to have been provoked in some way, which usually ended up applying in domestic violence murders, then they would be given a technically indeterminate sentence, but almost no one ended up serving more than 15 years. There were very few incarcerated individuals at that time who actually spent more than 15 years in prison, regardless of what they'd done. And here, these three were being given 12 years. To say that William was irate would be an understatement. And he would actually go on to use the sentence his brother had received as the reason he claimed for everything else he would do after this. Now, a lot of criminals claim to have this very virtuous reason for their crimes, which often doesn't add up when you dig a little deeper. And whether or not William really believed he and his brother had been done in, he was very wrong about one thing. He claimed that Jimmy's sentence had been unfair because his younger brother was a first-time offender. But Jimmy wasn't. Jimmy had actually spent 3 months in jail in Johannesburg while William had been travelling and hadn't shared that with his older brother. No one in the family had told William, and they never would. And so, the strange secrets became the thing that William apparently held on to as his reason for doing everything that would follow. Or so he said. While John Maxim had not been identified as a member of this iteration of the Foster gang, he did not manage to avoid jail entirely. He soon went back to his criminal ways and was arrested for another crime, ending up incarcerated with William, Jimmy, and Fred in Pretoria Central. As 1914 dawned, Peggy Foster had given birth to a baby girl, who met her father for the first time during a prison visit. It seemed terribly sad that the child would be almost 12 by the time she would know her father outside of prison walls. And it seems William thought so too, because he wasn't planning on being in prison for that long. 6 months into his prison stint, William made friends with the prison tailors and convinced them to make him a suit. Then, on the 27th of February 1914, he made his move. Every day, those sentenced to hard labour would be brought out to the stone quarry behind the prison and made to hack away at the stone for hours on end. The area in which they worked was cordoned off enough that it should have made escape impossible. But it was indeed possible, as William Foster soon proved. He had hidden his suits in a plastic bag behind some rocks, and he'd also managed to get his hands on some wire cutters. While working at the rock quarry that day, he instigated a fight between several of the prisoners, and as chaos erupted and the guards scrambled to regain control, William slipped away, unnoticed. He quickly shed his identifiable prison overalls, put the suit on, and snipped his way through the wire prison gates and out onto the street. In a flash, he was gone. John Maxim was due to be released the following month anyway, so he decided it wasn't worth the risk for him to escape with William. William hadn't wanted Jimmy and Fred to take the risk of escaping with him. He'd promised his brother that once he'd managed to get enough money together, he'd make a plan to get him out. Police figured that William might arrive to visit his wife and daughter, so they kept an eye on her home. But there was no sign of the man, and the months ticked by with Foster remaining on the run. All of this was happening around a time when police, and most authorities really, had quite a lot on their hands. World politics were in chaos, and a world war loomed. The still mainly British colonial government of what was then still the Union of South Africa were keen to have South Africa and its army join the war on the side of Britain. But the Afrikaners, who were still smarting over the loss of the Second Boer War, were very unhappy about this prospect. They wanted the Union to support Germany. And as a result, there were many public protests and uprisings across the country for the police to contend with. They simply did not have much time to dedicate to finding this runaway robber. When John Maxim was released in March 1914, he quickly connected with his friend, and soon they had a third man along for the ride. Karl Mazar was just 21 years old, and he was perhaps the most criminally experienced of the three men. He was also proficient with firearms, and had a skill that William Foster had decided was important. He could ride a motorcycle. William had figured that motorcycles were actually a more efficient getaway than cars, so he'd stolen a few until he managed to get two together that were in good condition. He'd also stolen a car, but that was to use when he had to transport his wife and child, who had by now been spirited out of where they'd been living and into a hideout he'd arranged for them and his two would-be accomplices. The house was in Regent's Park and perfectly nestled among a bunch of other nondescript houses. It was a family neighbourhood, so it was a little strange to some that three men, one woman and a baby lived in a house, but the residents didn't cause any trouble, so they let them be. From June 1914, trouble was most definitely what the group was causing, though. Over the space of a few weeks, they committed several smaller, less noticeable crimes. The car and the bike thefts, stealing groceries and liquor. Crimes all the same, but nothing that would be tied back to them until they started the really big ones. They decided that hitting targets during the day was too risky, and they didn't want anyone to be around. So the men started targeting post offices, banks, and large liquor stores at night. Part of their modus operandi became the use of dynamite, which they would use to either blow up walls to gain entry or blow up safes to get to valuables or money. In Roodepoort, they targeted a national bank branch. They got away with postal orders, and one witness said the men were on a motorbike, but that was all the information available at the time. Another of their targets was a post office in Vredendorp. There, they gained entry, blew up the safe, and got away with cash, as well as boxes of postage stamps. And it is here that their trail of bodies begins. Although this one was a little indirect, but still pertinent, I think. In the fallout from the investigation of this crime, the post office manager from Vredendorp was identified as having stolen £72 from the cash register in the weeks before the robbery. The man said he'd been struggling financially and had to buy a new car to get to work and transport his four children and pregnant wife, and he hadn't been able to make ends meet after that. He said he'd always intended to pay the money back, and it was shown that he had actually already paid some of it back. But of course, this didn't negate the fact that he'd stolen from his employer, and the Foster gang robbery had exposed him. The man was not criminally charged, but he was fired and forced to pay back the full amount immediately, which bankrupted him. Shortly before his wife gave birth to their fifth child, he ended his own life. After the first two major robberies, police had already started to figure that they may be dealing with the Foster gang again. And the third robbery would turn the whole thing into a much more serious business. The Foster gang's next hit was another national bank, this time in Boksburg. Again, the gang hit after dark, and they broke into the business next door, and then blew a hole through the wall into the bank with dynamite. What they didn't know was that the bank had a guard who slept on the premises, and as soon as they heard the explosion, they fled across the road to a hotel and bar, shouting for help. The barman, Alexander Charlson, ran out into the street to see what was happening. He managed only a few steps in the bank's direction when a gunshot echoed through the night. Alexander collapsed onto the road. He'd been shot. Seconds later, 21-year-old Foster gang member Carl Mazar walked up to the writhing man and fired another shot into him, killing him instantly. A customer at the pub ran out to help when he heard the gunshots, and he too was shot. Thankfully, he was only wounded in the leg and survived. The Foster gang fled the scene on motorcycles, with nothing to show for their crime. Whether or not the murder had spooked the Foster gang, or perhaps they just realized that they needed to lay low for a while, they committed only petty acts of theft over the next few months. The police were likely very thankful for the reprieve too, as in July 1914, Britain officially declared war on Germany, and tensions in the Union reached fever pitch, as it was now clear the country would have to decide who to support in the war. The threats of the Foster gang faded into the background for a while, but in September, they were back, and their newest idea would change everything in the hunt for the now murderous gang. John Maxim had been involved in the illegal alcohol trade on and off over the years, so he knew quite a bit about how liquor stores operated, and he knew that generally, although they would bank their takings every weekday, because banks weren't open on the weekend, the weekend's takings would usually lay in the safe until Monday morning. So, the gang decided to hit one of the biggest liquor stores in the area, and to do it on a Sunday night. Although liquor laws differed across the country at the time, in Johannesburg, liquor sales were allowed on Saturdays, but banned on Sundays. And the biggest sales days were always Friday and Saturday. Then, Maxim said, the takings for those 2 days would stay in the safe. So, if they hit on a Sunday, not only would the business be closed, but they'd be assured a decent payday. The Foster gang knew that the murder of Alex Charlson had leveled up the search for them. And even though the police were distracted with protests around the war, they would soon turn their attentions back onto them. Their plan was to make this the last big hit, and then to flee to what is now Angola, and was at that time referred to as Portuguese Southwest Africa. They'd even started drying meat in Sebultong for the journey, and working on the car they'd stolen to ensure it was roadworthy enough to make the trip. This hit was also going to be one of their most risky, because the store they decided to target was less than a kilometre from Jeppe Police Station. To help give them the cover of darkness, a few nights before they'd gone out to the street the store was in and broken a streetlight that illuminated the street in front of the store. They knew it would take at least a week or two for it to be repaired, and that would give them more than enough time. Finally, on the evening of the 13th of September, the Foster gang left their hideout on their motorcycles. They approached the store on back roads, and when they arrived, Mazar and Maxim stood guard outside while Foster went inside. It was 1:30 a.m. when a guard who slept inside the building heard Foster trying to break in. He banged on the window, hoping that he'd scare the man off. And then he saw a police constable approaching on foot patrol in the road. The guard banged even harder and shouted, trying to get the police officer's attention. But instead, he watched as William Foster attacked the policeman with a crowbar, knocking him unconscious. The guard quickly raised the alarm, and the men fled on their motorcycles. They had a backup plan, though, and Maxim had identified another store that he believed would have a good amount of cash on the premises. This time, Maxim stayed outside while both Mazar and Foster went in. Mazar climbed in through a skylight and then unlocked the door from the inside to let Foster in. Then the two men identified the safe in the manager's office and blew it open with dynamite, only to discover that this liquor outlet did not keep their weekend takings on the premises. They only managed to net a few coins in change. While Foster and Mazar were busy inside, a patrolling police officer, Sergeant Neil McLeod, spotted John Maxim standing in the street and immediately thought it suspicious. He saw another officer, Sergeant Swanepoel, around the corner and approached him for backup. The two approached Maxim to ask him what he was up to. For the most part at that time, police officers who did foot patrols were only armed with batons, and that's exactly what these two had on them. Maxim claimed that he was just waiting for a tram. By this time, it was 4:30 a.m., and the trams didn't start running until 6:30 a.m., so that made no sense. Suddenly, out of nowhere, Maxim started whistling wildly. Of course, we know he was warning the two men inside,
But the cops had no idea what was going on, other than him behaving very oddly, so they arrested him. Upon searching him, they found a gun and housebreaking tools, and they knew they were onto something. As police were marching him up the road past the liquor store, Maxim started shouting for help. Within seconds, Foster appeared in the street, a gun pointed at the unarmed officers, demanding they release Maxim. McLeod whispered to Swanepoel to pull the gun they'd just taken from Maxim, and as the officer did, Foster opened fire. Sergeant McLeod was hit 6 times and died on the scene. Sergeant Swanepoel was hit once, but managed to survive. By this time, Mazar had also emerged and pulled their motorcycles around, and they threw Maxim, still cuffed, on one and all headed off into the night, leaving Swanepoel to crawl and limp down the road to find help. When police descended on the scene, they would discover that when Mazar had gone around the corner to retrieve the motorcycles, he'd run into another police officer who'd heard the gunshots and was responding to figure out what was happening. Mazar shot that police officer, Sergeant Robert Mansfield, and he too died on the scene. The murders of the police officers triggered a major response, and police realized that they were going to have to fight fire with fire. Roadblocks were set up on every major road around Johannesburg, and all the police officers at those roadblocks were given guns. Police also put out a plea to the public for information. The Foster gang, and William Foster in particular, were now public enemy number one. Tips flooded in, and one in particular stood out. A woman in Regent's Park was 100% sure that she had the Foster gang living in the house next door to her. Everything seemed to match. 3 men, 1 woman, a baby, motorcycles, and strange nighttime activity. Senior officers sent 3 police officers out to speak with the woman, but warned them not to approach the house on their own. If they confirmed the information with the tipster and believed that they were onto something, they should call in for backup before approaching the house. Unfortunately, the officers did not heed this warning. After talking to the tipster, they were convinced that this was the right house, and they snuck a peek over the wall. There in the yard, they spotted Foster and Mazar working on a car. Nearby, Peggy was holding the baby, preparing to get into the vehicle. The officers decided that they needed to use the element of surprise and couldn't risk the gang fleeing. So 2 of them held a perimeter, and the 3rd, Detective Charles Minnett, scaled the wall and approached Foster, who was bent over the engine of the car with his back facing the detective. Unfortunately, Minnett had failed to spot John Maxim, who was under the car working on something else. Maxim, however, saw Minnett and shouted out to warn Foster, who grabbed a gun he'd had hidden in the car's engine. Without a single word exchanged, Foster swiveled around and began firing at Minnett, who was hit 7 times and died on the scene. The other police officers began exchanging gunfire with Mazar and Foster, while Maxim quickly loaded Peggy and the baby into the car and told her to crouch down in the back. When the police officers ran out of ammunition, Mazar shouted at them to toss their weapons over the wall and put their hands in the air, or he'd kill them both. The officers complied, likely certain that Mazar was about to shoot them anyway, but he hadn't. Instead, the next thing the cops heard and saw was the squealing of tires and the gang in the car tearing out of the driveway and down the road. A crowd of residents had gathered upon hearing the gunshots, and some of them tried to block the car from proceeding down the road. Foster fired 7 shots out the window, and residents dove for cover. Thankfully, none of them were injured. With another police officer dead, The information about the car the gang were traveling in was sent out to the roadblocks, and everyone was on high alert. The biggest concern was that the men were traveling with a woman and baby, and Peggy, as far as they knew, besides the harboring and assisting a fugitive part, hadn't actually committed any crimes. But the gang was far too dangerous to let them get away, and all officers across the region were prepared to do whatever they needed to stop them. Sadly, over the next 24 hours, the Foster gang hysteria would take another two lives, and that without the gang being anywhere near the victims. On the 15th of September at around 6 p.m., one Dr. Grace received a call that he was needed at Springs Hospital to perform an operation. He and his wife had gone into their car and headed off to the hospital at a relative speed. When the doctor saw the roadblock, he didn't think it was anything serious, as he hadn't been paying attention to the news and didn't know the Foster gang were on the move. The doctor's arrival at the hospital was important enough that he felt he couldn't waste any time, so he kept his speed up and prepared to ignore the officers waving him down. The police officers just saw a car that, in the fading light, could have matched the description of the car they were looking for, with a man and a woman in it. They saw a car that was not slowing down, and clearly preparing to speed through the roadblock, and they opened fire on the vehicle. Dr. Grace was killed instantaneously, as a bullet entered his vehicle and struck him in the head. His wife was shot in the arm and survived. A fifth life had been ended as a result of the Foster gang's actions. 2 hours later, another similar incident occurred. This time, it had possibly timeline-changing consequences for the entire country. The week before the Foster gang made its final stand and fled, a special sitting of Parliament had occurred, where a vote determined that South Africa would join the war on the side of Britain. The Afrikaner population were irate, and when the government ordered the South African army to head out to what is now Namibia and was then still German-governed territory and take control of the country on behalf of Britain, a very strange dynamic was revealed. The vast majority of the army's generals were Afrikaners, including the Brigadier General of the Army, Christiaan Beyers, and General Koos de la Rey. Yes, that de la Rey, the one from the song. And it was these same Afrikaner generals who were supporters of Germany. Now, they were being instructed to invade Namibia on behalf of South Africa and, by extension, Britain. Many of the generals had refused, and both Beyers and de la Rey were now no longer part of the army. But they'd not given up on their mission. That night around 8 p.m., de la Rey and Beyers were in a car headed out to Potchefstroom, where they were allegedly set to meet another 1,600 like-minded men gathered there. The plan was to storm the capital and overthrow the government. The involvement of General de la Rey in the plan was vitally important, as was the date. Sina van Rensburg, a seer, had made predictions, which had been interpreted as being about de la Rey, and a success that he would allegedly have in claiming the country for the Afrikaners from the British. And the dates the predictions had allegedly pinpointed was the 15th of September. This prediction had been seen as a sign from the heavens that the men were on the right track. As a side note, I was quite fascinated to read about how similar the scenario was to what I discussed when I interviewed author Karen Mitchell about her book The High Treason Club, and how those very same predictions from Sina van Rensburg had allegedly inspired another attempt to overthrow the government almost a century later. That attempt would also be thwarted by police, but in a very different way. As the car containing Delaray and Bayers headed down the road, they, like Dr. Grace and his wife 2 hours before, did not have the Foster gang on their minds. And by contrast, the police officers manning the roadblocks did not have two army generals on their minds either. Officers at that level had no idea what was happening politically, and it's really unknown whether police were at all aware of the group that was gathering in Potchefstroom. They certainly didn't seem to be looking for Delaray or Bayers, but the two men in the car were on edge, certain that their country had turned against them and they were being hunted. So, when they saw the roadblock, they believed it was for them, and they instructed their driver to put foot and speed straight through. Police fired 3 shots at the vehicle, and 1 bullet ricocheted off the road and entered the vehicle, striking Koos Delaray in the spine and killing him. The driver immediately stopped the vehicle, and when officers approached, they were incredibly confused to find not a single member of the Foster gang in the car. Equally, Bayers was shocked to learn that the officers hadn't been out to arrest them. For Delaray and the apparent 1,600 men on horseback waiting in Potchefstroom, the realization came too late, and the seer's predictions were suddenly meaningless. Another life had been taken as a result of the Foster gang's actions. There's really no way of knowing how South Africa's trajectory may have been impacted if the Foster gang had not been on the run that very night. It's unlikely, given the resources the British had access to, that the Boer attempt to overthrow the government would have been successful. But a clash of that magnitude would certainly have gone down in history, and perhaps may have even sparked new internal conflict. The following day, police found the vehicle the Foster gang had been in abandoned on the side of the road near Kensington Ridge. They had suspected that one of the gang had been wounded, and their suspicions were confirmed when they found bullet holes in the car and blood on the passenger seat. The knowledge that one of the men was wounded and they were travelling on foot with a woman and child gave the police hope that they hadn't got very far. So scent dogs were brought out, and a huge number of police officers arrived at the scene to start searching. The dogs were given the bloodied car seat as a scent item, and the tracking began. The dogs picked it up immediately, and footprints were found too. Soon it became clear that the gang had split up with the tracks heading in 2 different directions. Police followed the track the scent dogs took them on, because they were pretty sure the blood was from William Foster, who'd been sitting in the passenger seat when they pulled away from the house. Suddenly, a cry rose up from one of the police officers who'd spotted a boot sticking out of the cave on the ridge. The minute the police officers descended, a gunshot came from the cave, narrowly missing the men gathered nearby. That was their confirmation, though. They had found the Foster gang, and they were cornered. As news spread to surrounding stations, more officers descended on the ridge. The gang was refusing to respond to the shouted requests from police, and it was getting dark. Everyone was concerned that the gang would sneak out in the dark and flee again. So without another plan to get them out until daybreak, and no one willing to risk more police officers dying in a shootout, rocks were dropped in front of the entrance to the cave, essentially sealing the men in. By daybreak, the press had descended on the scene, as well as a huge crowd of members of the public. A few different techniques had been attempted to get the men to come out, including smoking them out with tear gas, which went badly wrong when the wind suddenly switched directions and the tear gas descended on the gathered crowd instead. Finally, a faint voice emerged from the cave. It was William Foster. He said he wanted to see his family. Several members of the Foster family had already started gathering at the scene after receiving the news about the standoff. But Foster said he also wanted to see Peggy and his daughter, and he told police where to find her. It became clear that although the three men were in the cave, it had been Peggy and the child who had split off from them after William had sent them to a designated safe house he'd arranged in Germiston. William Foster said that if police brought his family in and allowed him to talk to them, he would come out with his hands up and accept arrest. Senior police officials debated over whether to give in to William's demands. They knew very well that they were putting innocent people in harm's way by allowing them to enter. But after speaking with the Foster family, it was clear that they wanted to speak with William and were not afraid to enter the cave. Peggy and the baby were another matter, but a car was sent to collect them. John and Elizabeth Foster, as well as two of William's sisters, entered the cave. Shortly afterwards, Peggy arrived with the baby, and she too was allowed to enter. The crowd bade insults at the woman as they saw her appear from the car. She ignored them, and just before disappearing into the mouth of the cave, instructed police to provide something to drink. Bottles of tea, as well as cigarettes and matches, were delivered to the edge of the cave. And then senior officials, knowing full well that they had just taken an enormous risk with several innocent lives, including a child, sat and waited. What happened inside the cave that day is, of course, only truly known by those who were there. But Foster's family later said that they found a disturbing scene inside. Carl Mazar was dead. It appeared he'd already died the day before. It seemed to be by his own hand, although some sources question whether that was indeed the case. William was injured. He'd sustained not one, but three gunshot wounds in the shootout with police and had lost a lot of blood. John Maxim was alive and uninjured and sat with a gun in his lap. He acknowledged the Fosters, but seemingly was already psychologically shut down. Peggy passed the baby to William, and he sat with her in his lap for a while. Then he told his family what his plan was. He said that he was sorry about the people who had died, but all he'd wanted was money. In addition, he said, all his actions had actually been the fault of Judge Kotzer, the judge who had sentenced his brother to 12 years in prison. He stuck to the narrative about his poor little brother having been a first-time offender. The family did not correct him. Then he told them he had no plans to leave that cave alive. He would not be going back to prison, and he knew very well that if he was arrested, he would be given the death penalty anyway, as he'd killed a police officer. So he said he'd carry out the death sentence himself, rather than give authorities the opportunity, and just extend his suffering. His family said they tried to talk him out of it, even suggesting he could escape by dressing up in his sister's clothes and sneaking out with the family. But William was set on his decision. They would never stop hunting him, he knew, even if he got away now. He kissed his baby girl on the head one last time and handed her back to Peggy. Peggy, who had remained silent for the most part while William had spoken of his plan, stood up and handed the child over to one of William's sisters. She said she was staying with William. She could not see a life without him, she said, and she'd rather be dead if he was. William did not try to talk her out of it. Outside the cave, police officers watched as, one by one, the Foster family members exited the cave. The most senior police officer, who had been the one to make the decision to allow Peggy and the baby to enter the cave, watched with horror as he saw William's sister carrying the child, and no sign of Peggy. The family were just clear of the cave when three gunshots in succession rang out. And then, ominous silence. Police moved toward the cave carefully, concerned that Foster may be setting them up for an ambush. But when one brave officer popped his head around the cave wall, his grey turning pallor said it all. There are, again, conflicting accounts about who may have shot whom. Some sources say John and William had agreed that William would shoot Peggy, and then John would shoot William, and John would shoot himself. Others say William did all the shooting and then shot himself. William Foster's genealogy page says that he was assassinated in a suicide pact with John Maxim. But then it also lists his occupation as photographer. On John Maxim's body, police found keys to the Boksburg National Bank branch. The boxes of stamps stolen from the post office were also in the cave. The bank drafts that had been stolen remain missing to this day. Mazar, Maxim, Peggy and William's bodies brought the Foster gang's death toll in total to 11. But there would be at least one more casualty of their deeds. The senior police officer who had made the decision to allow Peggy into the cave could not come to terms with her death. He felt that Peggy had been under the manipulation and control of William Foster, and she had not been thinking clearly. He felt responsible for her death. And not long after, he took his own life. Peggy and William Foster were buried together in Braamfontein Cemetery. Carl Mazar was buried in the plot beside them, and John Maxim was interred in the same section of the cemetery. The Foster gang was gone, but the impact they'd had on South Africa in such a short period would continue on, even if only just as a tale passed down through generations. Another impact and a first this case made was as related to the reward. Remember that £500 reward offered by American Swiss after the first robbery? Well, there were several claims on that reward, most notably by Harry Bloom, who'd called police to Ebenezer House, and then also Ernest Sefton, the left luggage clerk. Both men had supplied important information to police, which had directly led to the arrest of the Foster gang for that first crime. But Harry had the best chance, because he had actually approached police himself, while Ernest had been approached by police and then provided the information he had at that time. Ultimately, though, the matter would end up in court. Bloom had called police on the 20th of March, but the reward had only been advertised in the newspapers the following day. Up until then, there was no real legal ruling around rewards of this nature offered in South Africa. But this case had the judge create a legal precedent in which he said that the publication of the reward was the mechanism of a contract between the entity offering the reward and the person claiming it. And that contract could only be entered into after the publication. So, because Harry had provided his information just a few hours prior to the actual publication of the reward, there was no contract between him and American Swiss, and the company was not obliged to pay him the reward if they chose not to. There's no clarification that I could find confirming whether they chose to do so or not, but that legal precedent about rewards stands to this day in South Africa. Of course, today, the publication of a reward also includes mechanisms like digital media, radio, and arguably, possibly even mechanisms like large WhatsApp groups in the cases of rewards for missing pets, for instance. But Every time a reward is issued in South Africa today, there's an echo of that group of men who kept the country in the grips of terror for months. Whenever I cover vintage true crime cases like this, I wonder whatever happened to the descendants of people like William Foster. South Africa's genealogy records aren't really great for public access. So although I was able to determine what Peggy and William's little girl had been named at birth, there seemed to be no way to figure out what her life had been like. I didn't even know which foster sister had taken her in. Then I came across a truly interesting story that took place more than two decades after Peggy Foster had handed her baby over and resigned herself to death. In June 1937, a man named Andries du Plessis was arrested in Steubenville by one detective, Michiel Ackerman, and charged with murder. At the time of his arrest, he was in the company of a woman who later claimed that she was the daughter of William and Peggy Foster. When du Plessis went to trial for his crime, he insisted that the woman had not been guilty of anything and hadn't contributed to his crimes at all. The woman was released without further charge. Andries du Plessis was convicted and sentenced for the murder he'd committed. And a few weeks later, this woman arrived at Detective Ackerman's office to collect some of Andries' belongings. The detective hadn't really put much stock in the woman's claims initially, figuring that she was just trying to garner some sort of favour or distract him with her tales of her connection to the infamous Foster gang. Still, when she arrived at his office, he got her talking and she shared a little more information about her life. The woman claimed that she'd been married to a policeman and they'd lived together in the Eastern Cape. But she'd fallen in love with a man who worked on the mines and she'd left her husband and moved to Durban. This relationship hadn't worked and she then decided to move to Johannesburg where she'd been born and lived for a short time in her childhood. There, she'd met and fallen in love with du Plessis. She said that she had been attracted by his impulsive and reckless nature. Du Plessis had been married at the time, but he left his wife for her, and they went on to carry out several robberies together. She said that at first she'd just been a lookout, but later she'd become more involved. She further claimed that du Plessis had murdered seven people during these robberies. The police had suspected that he'd murdered as many as five, but they could only prove one, which was the one he was convicted of. The woman said that she had just searched the pockets and belongings of the victims at first, but eventually she confessed that she'd actually shot and killed an eighth victim herself. Now, a confession alone is not nearly enough to convict anyone of anything. And Detective Ackerman had no evidence against the woman. So he'd had no choice but to release her. She disappeared and was never heard from again. Ackerman was pretty fascinated with the idea that she might be the Foster's daughter, though. And he checked on some of the information she'd given him about her family. Details that he claims were not public knowledge. And he was certain that she was indeed who she said she was. We will never know for sure, and it seems a horrific irony that Peggy's daughter would be drawn into exactly the same kind of situation her mother had been. But it's also not uncommon for people looking for attention to claim to have links to infamous families. Maybe she was Peggy and William's daughter. Maybe she wasn't. Either way, she would most certainly be deceased by now. But maybe, just maybe, she had children. And maybe those children had a story whispered to them when their mom was feeling brave. a family secrets about the things their grandfather did, and the people whose lives were ended and changed as a result, including theirs. Alexander Charlson, Sergeant Neil McLeod, Sergeant Robert Mansfield, Detective Charles Minnett, and all the others who lost their lives in the aftermath of these crimes. Rest gently. For more victim-focused true crime contents, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcasts on social media platforms for updates on new episodes and other crime-related stuff. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. CCSA has partnered with the SA Criminologist platform. And if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime-themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za. And support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.